welcome to another episode of Unearthing Paranormalcy, the podcast where we dig into the paranormal and try to find normalcy in the topic. I'm Amy.
I'm Dave.
I'm Chad.
And I'm Eli.
And this week, we're going to continue our disappearance of aviation.
Aviation disappearances?
Yeah, something like that. Why not?
Appearances, aviation.
Where the planes go bye-bye.
Where the plane was there before, eh? Not there no more.
I'm really liking this twist we're doing on this missing person stuff.
Yeah. Well, our missing persons episodes do really, like, people seem to really like those. So it's like, well, we'll do some more.
It's like history. It's like the History Channel meets conspiracy theory.
I love it.
Oh, me too.
We just need Dan Aykroyd to help with conspiracy theories.
Yeah, we do.
I mean, I feel like everything
go to aliens with him.
Yeah, I was going to say, I feel like everything would go to aliens or Men in Black.
Yeah. All right, Chad, so start us off. What is your missing aviation?
All right, I picked one of the most famous women in history, actually.
Me?
Amelia, yes.
Angelina Jolie?
Close.
Okay, okay. Oprah?
Almost. Almost. I put with Amelia Earhart, which is a story that, like, I've always been kind of intrigued by. So
Amelia, Amy. I mean, it all works.
I mean, her mother's name, went by Amy. So
I bet Amy was hot.
I say Amy is a nickname for Amelia.
So. Amelia Earhart was born on July 24th in 1897 in Atchison, Kansas.
We are almost birthday sisters too.
Yeah, only 5 days off.
5 days off,
and
in a few years,
quite a few years.
And not far state-wise either. I mean, Kansas and Oklahoma are like just right there. Bam!
She spent much of her early childhood in the upper-middle-class household of her maternal grandparents. Earhart's mother, Amelia Amy Otis, married a man who showed much promise but was never able to break the bonds of alcohol. Edwin Earhart was on a constant search to establish his career and put the family on a firm financial foundation. When the situation got bad, Amy would shuttle Earhart and her sister Muriel to their grandparents' home. There they sought out adventures, exploring the neighborhood, climbing trees, hunting for rats, taking breathtaking rides on Earhart's sled. When 10-year-old Amelia Mary Earhart saw her first plane at the state fair in Iowa, she was not impressed. It was a thing of rusty wire and wood and looked not at all interesting, she dismissively said. It wasn't until she attended a stunt flying expedition almost a decade later that she became seriously interested in aviation. A pilot spotted Earhart and her friend, who were watching from an isolated clearing, and dove at them. "I'm sure," he said to himself, "watch me make them scamper," she exclaimed. Earhart, who felt a mixture of fear and pleasure, stood her ground. As the plane swooped by, something inside her awakened. "I did not understand at the time," she admitted, "but I believe the little red airplane said something to me as it swished by." On December 28, 1920, pilot Frank Hawks gave her a ride that would forever change her life.
I bet he did.
Giggity.
By the time I'd got 300 feet off the ground, I knew how to fly, she said. Although Earhart's convictions were strong, challenging, prejudicial, and financial obstacles awaited her, but the former tomboy was no stranger to disapproval or doubt. Defying conventional feminine behavior, a young Amelia climbed trees, belly slammed her sled to start it downhill, hunted rats with a .22 rifle. She also kept a scrapbook newspaper clippings about successful women in predominantly male-oriented fields, including film direction and production, law, advertising, management, and mechanical engineering.
I'm feeling some
kinship
here.
After graduating from Hyde Park High School in 1915, Earhart attended Agonts, a girls' finishing school in the suburbs of Philadelphia. And at this time, I mean, women weren't really accepted into many big colleges. A lot of women's colleges and girls' schools opened up to allow them to study, pursue careers and topics and stuff they were interested
in. But even still at that time, your main goal was to find a husband when you were at college.
Yeah.
Most of the women who went to college didn't finish because that was their...
Yeah.
Their overall goal was to find a husband.
And Amelia wasn't... She didn't want to be she didn't want to be that kind of woman. She wanted to make it for herself and then maybe later on do the family thing. But that wasn't her goal. She wanted to explore things for herself. She left in the middle of her second year to work as a nurse's aide in a military hospital in Canada during World War One. She then started taking medical school, going to medical school, and dropped out. She claimed that she just wouldn't be a good doctor. She always succeeded in everything she did, but starting medical school, she just decided, yeah, this isn't quite for me after.
I actually completely understand that. I couldn't be in the medical field myself. So, I mean, I completely understand how somebody could be like, yeah, nope, not mine.
After the war, she attended college and later became a social worker for the Denison House, a settlement house in Boston. From all accounts, she was actually really good at becoming a really good social worker. People said that she would have had a great career as a social worker if she hadn't have found flying. Earhart took her first flying lesson on January 3rd, 1921, and in 6 months she managed to save enough money to buy her first plane. The second-hand Kenner Airster was a two-seater biplane painted bright yellow. She nicknamed it the Canary, and she used it to set her first woman's record by rising to an altitude of 14,000 feet.
I would think planes would have been more expensive.
Probably.
Yeah, I would think so, too. But, I mean, at this time, planes were still brand new. The only thing they were used for was air shows.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, they were used in war and stuff. But other than that, at this point, I mean, commercial flights weren't a thing. I mean, they just weren't used for anything, so there wasn't a whole lot of monetary value in them.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
I guess you could save up your money for 6 months and, like, buy a boat or something. Yeah.
Well, you also got to think, like, in this time period, even, like, a house is still under, like, $2,000.
Yeah, so, but you're also making less than $1 an hour. So
true.
Just an interesting fact, her first lessons and everything were actually done by one of the first female pilots, and that's part of where she got this whole idea of making it big as a pilot and proving that, you know, women can do this. She had that kind of thrust upon her by her teacher, who had already kind of become one of the first pilots. She was the first one to teach, female to teach flying. One afternoon in April 1928, a phone call came for Earhart at work. "I'm too busy to answer just now," she said. After hearing that it was important, Earhart relented, though she thought it was a prank. It wasn't until a caller supplied excellent references that she realized that the man was serious. "How would you like to be the first woman to fly the Atlantic?" he asked, to which Earhart promptly replied, "Yes." After an interview in New York with the project coordinators, including book publisher and publicist George P. Putman, she was asked to join pilot Wilmer Bill Stoltz and co-pilot mechanic Louis E. Slim Gordon. The team left Trespassy Harbor, Newfoundland, in a Fokker F7 named Friendship on June 17, 1928, and arrived at Burryport, Wales, approximately 21 hours later. Their landmark flight made headlines worldwide because three pilots had died within a year trying to be the first woman to fly across the Atlantic. When the crew returned to the United States, they were greeted by a ticker tape parade in New York and a reception held by President Calvin Coolidge at the White House. From then on, Earhart's life revolved around flying. To start, she placed third at the Cleveland Women's Air Derby, later nicknamed the Powder Puff Derby by Will Rogers, which our airport is named after.
Yeah, who died in a plane crash.
Yeah.
But that's how all of our airports are named after people who died in plane crashes. Apparently, that's what we think of our airports.
Oh, you died in one? Yeah. Okay, yeah, we'll name it after you.
Well, they can't very well name the flight schools after you.
As fate would have it, George Putman entered her life too. The two developed a friendship during preparation for the Atlantic crossing and were married February 7th, 1931. Intent on retaining her independence, she referred to the marriage as a partnership with dual control. She also refused to take his name because she didn't want to be Mrs. Putman. She wanted to be Amelia Earhart. She wanted to make her own name, not go off of her husband's name, who was already a established publisher and stuff. Together, they worked on secret plans for Earhart to become the first woman and the second person to fly solo the Atlantic. On May 20th, 1932, 5 years to the day after Lindbergh, she took off from Harbor Grace, Newfoundland, to Paris. Strong north winds, icy conditions, and mechanical problems plagued the flight and forced her to land in a pasture in Londonderry, Ireland. After scaring most of the cows in the neighborhood, she said, "I pulled up in a farmer's backyard." As word of her flight spread, the media surrounded her, both overseas and in the United States. President Herbert Hoover presented Earhart with the gold medal for the National Geographic Society. Congress awarded her Distinguished Flying Cross, the first ever given to a woman. At the ceremony, Vice President Charles Curtis praised her courage, saying she displayed heroic courage and skill as a navigator at the risk of her own life. Earhart felt the flight proved that men and women were equal in jobs requiring intelligence, coordination, speed, coolness, and willpower. In the years that followed, Earhart continued to reach new heights, setting altitude records for autogyros at 18,415 feet that stood for years. And there's actually a cool video of her flying the first autogyro, which is kind of a cool little... It's a no-wing plane that has like a helicopter propeller on top of it. It's actually really interesting to watch her fly it. There's a clip on YouTube that's really interesting to watch.
I will say that you were reading that and you said she reached new heights, and Dave's pungasm over there was quite entertaining to watch.
Yeah, I saw what you did there. I can't believe YouTube was around back then to film that. History's hard.
Surprisingly great picture, too.
On January 11th, 1935, she became the first person to fly solo across the Pacific from Honolulu to Oakland, California. Chilled during the 2,408-mile flight, she unpacked a thermos of hot chocolate. "Indeed," she murmured, "that was the most interesting cup of chocolate I've ever had. Sitting up 8,000 feet over the middle of the Pacific quite alone." Later that year, she was the first to solo from Mexico City to Newark. A large crowd overflowed the field and rushed Earhart's plane. "I was rescued from my plane by Husky policemen, one of whom, in the ensuing melee, took possession of my right arm and another of my left leg." Every time I read that, I think of she's like Frankenstein. Just like, "Oh, I got it, I got it." They started looting Amelia Earhart.
"Hey, give that back."
The officers headed for the police car, but they chose different routes. The arm holder started going one way, while the one who clasped my leg sat out the opposite direction. The result provided the victim with a fleeting taste of torture of the rack. But at that, she said good-naturedly, "It was fine to be home again." In 1937, as Earhart neared her 40th birthday, she was ready for a monumental and final challenge. She wanted to be the first woman to fly around the world. Despite a botched attempt in March that severely damaged her plane, a determined Earhart had a twin-engine Lockheed Electra rebuilt. "I have a feeling that there's just one more good flight in me, in my system, and I hope this is it," she said. And that's what she was telling George Putman before she left. Told him, this is probably going to be my last flight. You know, I hope it's a good one, which to me kind of foreshadows some stuff. But at the same time, it's just kind of interesting that she just knew she was done flying at this point. But on June 1st, Earhart and her navigator, Fred Noonan, departed from Miami to begin their 29,000-mile journey. By June 29th, when they landed in Ley, New Guinea, all about 7,000 miles had been completed. And where Ley is, it's New Guinea, you're looking at just northwest of Australia. More north of Australia, maybe just a little bit to the west. And frequently inaccurate maps had made navigation very difficult for Noonan, and their next stop to Howland Island was by far the most challenging. Located 2,556 miles from Ley in the middle of mid-Pacific, Howland Island is a mile and a half long by half a mile wide. I mean, she's aiming for a tiny island in the middle of the ocean.
That'd be easy to miss.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because that's smaller than, even Easter Island.
Yeah. I mean, there's videos of this island. I mean, it barely fits the airstrip that she was landing in. Like, I mean, it would have been very easy for a plane to misjudge their speed and just go right off the island into the water.
Yeah.
Very small. Hell, that's how I felt going to the Cayman Islands, because the runway ends at the ocean. And you come to land, and you're like, oh, God, please tell me we're going to stop. And I mean, you literally, you come to a stop 100 yards from the ocean, maybe. Oh, and you're just like, oh, God, thank God the brakes worked.
It's like taking off from an aircraft carrier.
Every essential item was removed from the plane to make room for additional fuel, which gave Earhart approximately 274 extra miles to make it to Howland Island. The U.S. Coast Guard cutter Itasca, their radio contact, was stationed just offshore of Howland Island, and they were there to help her in the refueling process, make sure she had everything she needed to get her on those last leg of the journey. Two other U.S. ships ordered to burn every light on board were positioned along the flight route as markers just to make sure they could spot the island and everything. On July 2nd at 10 a.m. local time, Greenwich time, the pair took off. Despite ideal weather reports, they flew into overcast skies and intermittent rain showers. This made Newton's favorite method of tracking celestial navigation difficult. As dawn neared, Earhart called to Itasca, reporting cloudy weather. I mean, I would think cloudy weather would be cloudy, but that's that's just me.
The weather report today, it's cloudy with a chance of clouds.
Damn, I hate when it's like this. I like cloudy with a chance of snowballs.
Chance of meatballs.
Yeah. In later transmissions, Earhart asked the Itasca to take bearings on her. The Itasca sent her a steady stream of transmissions, but she could not hear them. Her radio transmissions, irregular through most of the flight, were faint or interrupted with static. At 17:42 a.m., the Itasca picked up the message, "We must be on you. We cannot see you. Fuel running low. Been unable to reach you by radio. We are flying at 1,000 feet. The ship tried to reply, but the plane seemed to not hear. At 8:45 a.m., Earhart reported, "We are running north and south." Nothing further was heard from her. And so you got to think, I pulled up a map just so I can figure out where this is. Just almost direct west, maybe slightly northwest of Le New Guinea. Little tiny island. And so what it seems like to me is they had overshot, like they'd gone too far north or too far south. Like they just flew back and forth trying to find this island when they reached where the supposed area should be. Now you got to think, they had to have been close enough for Itasca to receive radio transmissions, but they couldn't spot her. Neither could any of the ships who were marked along the
way. And she's only flying at 1,000 feet. Yeah. So she's flying below cloud level, probably.
And you just got to think, I mean, it's 8:45 in the morning, so the sun's going to be up. Yeah, even if it's a little cloudy, you think they would have been able to spot her.
Or hear her or something, yeah.
Well, they could hear her. Oh, yeah, they couldn't hear the plane or anything. I mean, they did say, I think the plane would have had to been within 100 miles for them to receive radio transmission, but for as clearly as Itasca was receiving it, she had within 50 miles of where they were at. So you'd think they would have seen her in the distance or something. A rescue attempt immediately commenced and became the most extensive air and sea search in naval history. On July 19th, after spending $4 million in scouring 250,000 square miles of ocean, the United States reluctantly called off the operation. In 1938, a lighthouse was constructed on Howland Island in her memory. And across the United States, streets, schools, and airports are named after Earhart. Her birthplace, Atchison, Kansas, became a virtual shrine to her memory. Amelia Earhart Awards and scholarships are given out every year. Despite many theories, though no proof of Earhart's fate exists, there is no doubt, however, that the world will always remember Amelia Earhart for her courage, vision, and groundbreaking achievements, both in aviation and for women. In a letter to her husband written in case dangerous flight proved to be her last, her brave spirit was clear. "Please know I am quite aware of the hazard," she said. "I want to do it. I want to do it because it's what I want to do. Women must try to do things as men have tried. When they fail, their failure must be but a challenge to others." Now, I mean, they searched up until
World War II started, pretty much. And then they cut out the search for the war. Once the war ended, they went right back to searching. They scoured islands around it, the sea. No wreckage was ever found. Now, conspiracy theories on Amelia Earhart's disappearance range all over the place. So that she never actually left Le New Guinea and just pretended to fly, to crashing in the ocean, to landing on a deserted island and being a castaway, to being forced down and captured by the Japanese. There's no true evidence of anything, but there are snippets here and there that people have claimed to have or have seen, or some people even claim to have met her on a trip to Japan and instantly recognized who she was. And she just pretty much would have been taken hostage and then spent the rest of her life there and everything. Now, the first conspiracy theory I'll talk about is there is an island about, I want to say it's less than 100 miles south of Howland Island, named Gardner Island. It is a much smaller island. I mean, Howland Island's already tiny, and this one's smaller than that. Just big enough for a plane to land on. There were reports that the Tasca still received radio transmissions from Amelia's plane up to 2 weeks after her missed landing. Once again, they claim that her transmission had been within 100 miles of the Tasca for them to receive it. Also, with a Lockheed Electra, the plane had to have been on all, still had to have been flyable. It had to have been on wheels to charge. They had would have had to been able to roll the plane back and forth to charge the radio to be able to send these frequencies for up to 2 weeks.
Yeah, that's a great point.
When searching, they did. One of the naval ships did claim that Gardner Island looked to have been had some inhabitants over time, like recently. But they were told that some local people, local group, had been using that island for training purposes. Nowadays, we've learned that no training ever existed on that island. But they had found ways that looked like inhabitants, little structures built and stuff like that on the island. So the first conspiracy theory is that she landed on Gardner Island, sent out transmissions to try to get help. I heard there's claims that people have gone, over the years, have gone to Gardner Island looking for evidence that she was there. There were claims of plane parts being found inland that looked like they'd been used to, at some point had been used for other stuff. There are believed to be bones of a castaway found on the island, along with a woman and a men's shoe, and a radio box, or a navigational box, that was the same type that Fred Noonan had used. Now, these claims, no one's been able to find the evidence for these claims, but multiple documentaries bring this up. Even the National Greek, or not, the History Channel, and a couple of the documentaries bring this up, which just makes me think it has to have some kind of footing. Kind of
something behind it, yeah.
Did she have any children?
No. Okay. She had been married, but it wasn't. It was more of a, she calls it a partnership, and it was more of a partnership. He helped. He kind of became her agent.
Okay.
Helped set up all her flights, publishing, all this stuff.
So there's no descendants that they could, like, run DNA off of for, like, yeah, any bone marrow?
They'd have to go off of her sister.
Yeah. And her sister had, Muriel has a daughter, and there's a documentary on Netflix, I think it's called The Tale of Two Sisters, and it's an interview with Amelia's niece, and she talks about growing up, and Amelia was family-oriented, but only to an extent when she was in town, would come, say hi. She looked at everything as a business perspective. She would loan money to her parents or her sister, but only expect money and back in return.
After her disappearance, Putnam, her husband, took full financial responsibility for her aging mother, who was dealing with some illnesses, and supported her until she passed away. He helped Muriel write a biography about Amelia. He didn't want people to forget her. So he had his sister help write a biography for her. So it's one of those, a lot of people, there's conspiracies that he was part of, like he knew, he helped her disappear, like for the money aspect and everything. But the fact that he did all this for her family afterwards, he helped spend money to search for her, makes me think that he wasn't part of it.
Yeah.
And I will say the castaway conspiracy is actually is the conspiracy that I believe in. A lot of people with the wrecks, people say, or there's a conspiracy that she just ran out of fuel, tried to land on the ocean, and the ship just sunk. And that would be a conspiracy that does kind of stand up, because there wouldn't be any wreckage, because the plane was designed to be able to land in water, but it wouldn't float for long. It was meant to kind of land on water and then kind of skid up to land.
Okay. I know what you're talking about. Yeah.
So there's a chance that would happen, so there wouldn't have been wreckage or anything. The idea that she crashed into the ocean with how quickly, I mean, within 24 hours, they had ships sailing 250,000 miles of ocean looking for her. So I would think they would have seen wreckage.
Well, I would think with her flight experience, too, she knew her fuel was getting low. I'm going to bet she more than anything was searching for a place to land it.
Yeah.
And that was her whole goal, was to land and then get the ships to come to her to refuel her.
And what my guess is that with the navigation being harder with the clouds and stuff, the cloudy day and everything, that they maybe went a little too south or overshot the island and missed it, and then going north and south trying to find it, like, okay, it should be at these bearings, I'm just going to fly north and south until I find it, started running out of fuel, and just went, okay, there's an island, we're going to land it here, because she wasn't able to receive the radio transmissions from the Itasca, so they don't know if they're anywhere close.
Yeah,
they don't know that the Itasca can hear them.
Yeah,
but the fact that there are multiple reports of naval ships still receiving radio transmissions for up to 2 weeks after. She had to have landed somewhere close to them.
Yeah.
Yeah, because you're just not going to, like, pull the radio out of it and then get on an island, like, wash up on shore and then make a battery out of, like, coconuts or something.
Yeah. It's not Gilligan's Island.
Yeah, absolutely.
I don't know. Maybe they landed and they were just lucky enough that there was a professor there. And that professor was able to build them a raft.
Which, I don't know, it sounds like her background. She might have been smart enough to pull it off.
True.
But she did seem to be very smart. And when she was here in the United States, she did really push for women's rights.
Yeah.
She tried everything she could do to help push women into fields that were male dominated.
Yeah.
Now, this other one. This other conspiracy theory is a very common one. There was a photo taken, I want to say in the 1940s, by a Japanese Air Force or Japanese forces, of a Lockheed Electra, exact same style plane that she was flying, with a young man kind of in the corner of the photo who has a very close resemblance to Fred Noonan, and in the background kneeling towards the Electra is a young woman who people claim to say she resembles Amelia. And in documents that were sent with this photo, the Japanese are talking about this American pilot, female pilot they captured.
So wouldn't that just be straight proof at that point?
But I've looked at the photo. You can't see Amelia's face, so you can't tell it's her. You can't really tell whether it's Fred Noonan. I mean, you got to think this is 1940s photographs. They're not, 12 or 20 megapixels. Like, they're black and white, hard to read. And there's no proof that this photo was taken after disappearance, that it was actually real.
How many female pilots were there at that time?
There wasn't a lot, but there were still some. But doesn't mean this was a true photo. This could have been some random people taking a photo of her while she was getting ready for a flight somewhere. Yeah. She's flown across the world, not all the way across the world, but different areas of the world dozens of times at this point. But here's a map of this is where she was supposed to land, this dot here. And then that's Gardner Island, just south of it.
Okay.
So it's very possible, you know, they overshot Howland Island and just went up and north and south and then finally found this island and went to. And that would have been within the radio range of the Itasca sitting off the coast here.
Yeah. Yeah, very much. I don't know the validity of this, but this was uploaded on February 2nd. And some divers found a plane like that.
Yeah.
Now, there is, I want to say it's Destination Truth that was on History Channel.
Uh-huh.
I want to say it's that show. I watch a show, like that. And they went searching for Amelia Earhart's missing plane around Papua New Guinea. Because a lot of people believe that she couldn't find the island. Like, she flew off, noticed something was wrong, turned back. She shouldn't have had enough fuel to get back to Papua New Guinea, but some people say if somehow she had. So they checked there. And even in that show, in Papua New Guinea, they go to Gardner Island and everything, and they find multiple pieces of planes. And one of them was an engine block that would have matched. Had a different serial number, so it wasn't from the same, but it would have been from a Lockheed Electra, which was really interesting. And that was a really good show to watch for that. It had a lot of information in it. I didn't watch it for this episode. I watched it a year ago or so, because I really loved that show. But
so that's weird that it would be the same kind of engine, but with a different serial number.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Is that maybe something somebody brought there for, like, a tourist attraction type thing, or so
it's
a hoax?
It's out in the middle of nowhere, and, like, it's grown over in, like, foliage, and, like, it very well could have been someone was like, hey, I'm going to do this. I'm going to try to make some money to tell people it's Amelia Earhart's plane. And then
and he's like,
when people showed
shit.
Up, they're like, oh, that's not it, and they just left it there.
Yeah,
and then it got covered up over the years. With
he's like, oh, I didn't know they put serial numbers on the engine blocks.
I spent a lot of money for no reason. But the conspiracy theories still go on. There's still hundreds of people out there who are searching for her.
Yeah.
I mean, this is almost 80 years later.
Oh, yeah, people go
actually,
out.
Almost exactly 80 years later.
People
and
go
people
out
are still going out there looking for it.
Oh, yeah.
Because she meant that much to American history that people are looking for. Her family actually, I think 10 years after her disappearance, said they didn't want the U.S. to spend money on searching for her. That money could be used to help other people succeed in the world. Yeah. You could use that for scholarships. You can use that for medical research. Amelia did what she needed to do for the country.
Yeah.
She helped push women's rights way above where it was when she started.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And so they found peace with that she was gone. Even conspiracy theories that she knew this was going to be her last flight. She wanted to die doing what she loved. And that's why she told Putman, I got one good flight in me. I hope this is it. Is that she made it this far. She made it farther than any woman had ever made it. Circling the globe.
She almost made it to her birthday.
Mm-hmm. And decided, you know, this is a good this is going to be it. I'm going to end it here.
Yeah.
And crash the plane. But once again, I think with the research I've done and with the stuff I've heard about Gardner Island, I really think she landed on Gardner Island and pretty much lived there until she died to the elements.
Or what if somebody...
There's not food on that island.
Yeah.
It's a tiny island. There's no
Your food's going to be fishing.
Yeah,
and
she's got to be fishing. But then you have the sun that's going to beat
Is
down
there
on
any foliage in?
Yeah, I mean, there are trees and stuff. And they
you got to get water from somewhere because you can't drink the seawater.
You have to get rain. But that's the theory that I kind of stick with.
I like that theory the best of the ones you talked about. Now, the Japanese photo, I mean, I've looked at it.
I could.
They don't
no
look like
I
they're in distress
tell.
To be like hostages, though.
Yeah.
Like, he's standing there just like, looks like he's got a smile on his face, and her face is away from you, so you can't see.
And it's possible maybe they landed at sea, and this Japanese fisherman found her and brought her back. Because like, me and Amy looked at the photo again, and you can't see a plane anywhere, even though that the plane is described in every existence of this photo. But maybe they were rescued by fishermen and brought to shore, and, you know, Japanese didn't speak English at this time.
Yeah.
No way of communicating with her. And maybe she's tried to communicate with the United States, trying to, hey, we're here, come save us. And at this time, I mean, this is right before, this is literally right before World War II. I doubt the Japanese are letting her communicate with the U.S. Even if she's not a hostage, you know there's probably no transmissions going to and from.
They're not communicating with each other. Yeah.
And some believe that she made it back, and this was all a part of Putnam's plan to make her next. She wanted to be famous. She wanted to be known for, you know, women's rights and making, you know, that women can do anything, and that her disappearance while doing this would actually make her alleged and, you know, increase her fame, and that they faked the disappearance. There was many people who found this woman who looked identical to her, and then when they would confront her, she would, you know, claim, you know, I'm not Amelia Earhart. I'm not this mystery woman.
Yeah.
You know, this is my name and blah, 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 blah. And so a lot of people think that Putnam helped cover up her disappearance, or helped fake this disappearance so she could just go off and live a life.
Which is why her mother was taken care of, because she was having him do it for her, because she couldn't be there to do it.
That's another really good conspiracy that I thought
and
was
then
pretty good.
That's why eventually they were like, you know, let's just call off the search, because maybe they were feeling guilty about the money they were spending, knowing very well that
she was
somewhere and alive. Yeah. So
interesting.
But I've always been intrigued by the Amelia Earhart story. Yeah.
Our science museum used to have one of her jackets.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's still there or not. They've redone it so many times, but they used to have one of her jackets in their aerospace section, and they have a lot of it. They used to have a whole bunch of information about her.
Yeah.
So
I didn't know all those details of it.
Yeah, I didn't either.
And really a lot of this information you can get. There's an Amelia Earhart website, just AmeliaEarhart.com, with a biography. They're constantly posting news that, you know, for the searches that are going around for her remains, and just other things that are happening in the world since Amelia Earhart disappeared that are related to her, or the scholarships and awards in her name and stuff like that. It was a really cool kind of website. And then there's an award-winning movie that's called Amelia that's about her life. Hundreds of documentaries. But it was really fun to research this one, as someone who always kind of found her fascinating. So I really enjoyed this one. But once again, no one knows what happened.
Yep. She could have lived to a ripe old age.
Yep.
She could have passed away on
Gardner
Island. She could have crashed into
the ocean.
The ocean or a mountain, or who knows?
I mean, given the radio transmissions, that really only leaves it to Gardner Island.
Now,
or
those
else.
Last few radio like I said, that 2 weeks of radio transmissions, those are claims from people who were on board of the Itasca and stuff like that, but suppose there are no government records of transmissions after her claiming she's going north and south, can't find them, kind of thing.
But there
are multiple people on board of the Itasca who claim to have heard the radio transmissions for up to 2 weeks after while searching.
They're just not logged anywhere.
Yeah. So it's one of those. That's another thing that leads to the cover up of her disappearance. And oh, she crashed. Okay, we're gonna rescue her, but we're gonna tell people we never found her. And
So looking at photos, I just spent the last 2 minutes doing that. Looking at photos of the island that she supposedly landed on. I don't know, man. I feel like there's multiple situations that could happen. You said that the only way that the transmissions could last that long is if if they were able to still basically roll the plane back and forth, keep mm-hmm. the connection box connected. And it seems rather like, I don't know, like it, I know if I was doing it, but like, I'm not sure how well planes were made back then. But the only obvious point that I can kind of make out is that she didn't die at sea. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like she had to have either died on the island or, and or been picked up, period.
Yeah. I think with how big that plane would, what it was, if she would have crashed in the ocean, they would have found wreckage. The only thing that makes sense is if she had landed the plane successfully on the water and then it just sank over time. It would have sunk pretty quick. But
with that idea, though, there wouldn't have been transmissions, correct?
Yeah, they wouldn't have missing transmissions. Like I said, the transmissions are not government verified, but from crew members of the search parties, they were receiving these transmissions for up to 2 weeks. So, very interesting.
Very interesting.
Do we got any paranormal theories about it?
Aliens.
I can't think of any.
Okay, but like on the frail though, what
other
was she,
than like a time slip?
Yeah.
Maybe the clouds were yellow. No, I mean,
I'm just thinking like if we went to the Gardner Island and just played airplane noises and tried to go out there and like talk to
Amelia's spirit, find her ghost.
Yeah.
A lot of people have. I think people have tried to do that. Try to communicate with their.
We take a Luigi board.
A Luigi board, yes.
A Luigi board.
Yeah.
And Crapulet with us to Garner Island.
Yeah.
And we will find a millionaire.
I think I'll hide Josie in my carry-on luggage.
Okay. Yeah. I don't know if we're going to take a plane there, though.
According to legend, one more would have to die before the remains of Amelia Earhart be unearthed.
Next time on the episode of Gardner Island.
No, she made it all the way back and she crash landed on Oak Island.
She made it all the way past, all the way through the United States to the Northeast to crash on Oak Island.
And she flew a flag behind her that said, "I'm not Amelia Earhart."
Now, I'm a figment of your imagination.
Are there any islands that are like, I know you said that she'd have to be within 100 miles to do the transmissions, but just for some fluke reason, is there any within like 200 miles?
Let's see. I had
and maybe the storm was helping carry that transmission further, or some other kind of anomaly.
From Hawaii is the next closest island.
Oh,
and according to this map, and that was their next stop, and that was still another 700 miles, I think.
Yeah, that's way too far.
Yeah. Now, a lot of people do believe that she turned around and headed back to try to make it back to New Guinea. So, like, in that show, Destination Truth, I believe it was, he even searched New Guinea in areas that, from the airfield to the ocean, if she would have made it back somehow. If she had crashed landing on the island somewhere, if they would have found it or something like that. Because pretty much she went there, she stayed there, left. When she left, all the crew that was there to help her left as well. Like, it wasn't like she landed on an airport and, like, she landed just in the flat, you know, in the flattest area. They helped fill her up with fuel, sent her out, like, close to the coast so they could bring in fuel. Fill her up. She stayed the night, and then they flew off in the early morning.
So there's literally a crew just following her.
Yeah. So there's no evidence. Like, if they left and she did try to turn around and come back and crash on New Guinea, once again, there would have been no way for her to communicate besides her communicating. But that would have been almost 1,000 miles back. Almost like, let's say, almost 1,000 miles back if she had turned around. So
yeah,
yeah.
I don't think she would have tried. I think she was smart enough to I mean, she's flying low, too. So she's flying at 1,000 feet because she's trying to spot a little island to land on. Mm-hmm. So she's running low on gas. She's flying low. They see something. She's like, we have to try to land here. Otherwise, we're not going to make it anywhere
else. And it's possible
else.
She didn't know what the island looked like and found this one and finally was like, oh, this is it. Landed and it's like, well, where's the ship? They should be here.
Yeah.
Well, maybe they haven't been getting my transmissions. Maybe they moved someplace else. You know, I'll keep trying.
Yeah.
And
what were these transmissions like? Like Morse code or what?
Just radio transmissions of her calling out for the Itasca, supposedly.
And
Itasca, this is Amelia Earhart. I'm on this island. I mean, I don't know exactly what they were, but I'm sure it was, you know, just a normal call out, you know. We have land, you know, ran out of fuel, landed on islands, believed at this bearing, and just kept sending that, you know, the kind of a mayday kind of thing, just sending it over and over.
Yeah.
And it's possible it was a recorded message that she just constantly went and sent every day until the battery finally died and they couldn't get it going. And a lot of people believe that she landed to just much island. The plane landed so close to the coast or the shoreline that throughout the weeks with the tide and everything, it finally swept the plane back out into the ocean. So,
yeah.
But like I said, there were parts of the plane supposedly found on the island and everything. So,
interesting.
Or a plane, including a radio or navigation system that would have been the same that Noonan used.
At that point, when you realize that either people aren't coming or it's been way too long and you're exposed to the elements, at that point you have to break down shit.
Yeah.
To start building something.
Yeah. And you go into survival mode.
Yeah, and if the island is that low and it took them that long to even find the island at that point, there's plenty of storms that could have happened. There's plenty of things that could have happened to swept the island clean.
Yeah.
You know, because it's not that big of an island.
No.
You know?
Well, and out being, you know, the island is the highest place in that area. A storm, say a strong storm came through. Definitely, if you have a plane, you have a large lightning rod standing on the island. Say she's staying in the island, like, you know, staying, sleeping next to the plane or something like that. Could have been struck by lightning.
Sleeping in the plane.
Yeah. Been electrocuted from that lightning and then swept out to sea from over time as the tide came in. And, I mean, there's no telling.
That's very possible. I mean, it's an aluminum plane, isn't it?
I would have think it would have been.
I don't know if they were making steel planes back then or not.
All right, so that is Amelia Earhart. We're going to move on to mine. I'm going to finish out our aviation disappearances. On December 5th, 1945, a group of five Grumman TBM Avenger torpedo bombers took off from Fort Lauderdale, Florida, on course for a routine navigation and combat exercise named Navigation Problem 1. Navigation Problem 1 involved three different legs, with the fourth leg being a return to base. After takeoff, they were to fly 91 degrees, almost due east, for 56 nautical miles, which is about 64 miles, until reaching Hen and Chicken's Shoal, where a low-level bombing practice was to be carried out. Then they were to continue on that course for another 67 nautical miles before turning to a course of 346 degrees for 73 nautical miles. In this process, flying over the Grand Bahama Islands, the next scheduled turn was a heading of 241 degrees to fly another 120 miles, at the end of which the exercise was completed, and then the Avengers should turn left and return to Fort Lauderdale. The flight leader, Navy Lieutenant Charles Carroll Taylor, had about 2,500 flying hours, mainly in aircraft of this type, and his trainee pilots each had about 300 hours total, with only about 60 hours in the Avengers. The student pilots were U.S. Marine Captain Edward Joseph Powers and George William Stiver, U.S. Marine Second Lieutenant Forrest James Gerber, and USN Ensign Joseph Tipton Bozzi. Each plane was fully fueled, and during pre-flight checks, it was discovered that they were all missing clocks. Navigation of the route was intended to be a teach dead reckoning principles, which involve calculating, among other things, elapsed time. This apparent lack of timekeeping equipment was not a cause for concern, as it was assumed that each man had his own watch. Takeoff was scheduled for 13:45 local time, but because Taylor was late, they didn't depart until 14:10. Weather at the time was described as favorable. Sea state was moderate to rough. Taylor was supervising the mission, and the trainee pilots had the role of leader out front. Radio conversations between the pilots were overheard by base and other aircraft in the area. The practice bombing operation is known to have been carried out because about 1500 hour, a pilot requested and was given permission to drop his last bomb. 40 minutes later, another flight instructor, Lieutenant Robert F. Cox, FT-74, forming up with his group of students for the same mission, received an unidentified transmission. An unidentified crew member asked Powers, one of the students, for his compass reading. Powers replied, "I don't know where we are. We must have gotten lost after that last turn." Cox transmitted, "This is FT-74, plane or boat calling out Powers. Please identify yourself so someone can help you." The response after a few moments was a request from the others in the flight for suggestions. FT-74 tried again and a man identified as FT-28, Taylor, came on. FT-28, this is FT-75. What is your trouble? "Both my compasses are out," Taylor replied, "and I'm trying to find Fort Lauderdale, Florida. I'm over land, but it's broken. I'm sure I'm in the Keys, but I don't know how far down. I don't know how to get to Fort Lauderdale." FT-74 informed the NAS base that the aircraft was lost, then advised Taylor to put the sun on his port wing and fly north up the coast to Fort Lauderdale. Base operations then asked if the flight leader's aircraft was equipped with a standard YG IFF transmitter, which could be used to triangulate the flight's position. But the message was not acknowledged, by FT-28. Instead, at 16:45, FT-28 radioed, "We're heading 30 degrees for 45 minutes. Then we will fly north and make sure we are not over the Gulf of Mexico." During this time, no bearings could be made on the flight. The transmitter could not be picked up. Taylor was told to broadcast on 4805 kilohertz. This order was not acknowledged, so he was asked to switch to 3000 kilohertz. "The search and rescue frequency," Taylor replied. Taylor replied, "I cannot switch frequencies. I must keep my planes intact. At 1656, Taylor was asked again to turn his transmitter, if he had one. He did not acknowledge. A few minutes later, he advised that the flight changed course to 90 degrees due east for 10 minutes. About the same time, someone in the flight said, "Damn it, if we just fly west, we'll get home. Head west, damn it." This difference of opinion later led to questions about why the students just didn't simply head west on their own. This has been explained that it's because it's attributed to military discipline. You don't, your commander tells you to do something, you do it.
Disobey
you don't,
a direct order.
As weather deteriorated, radio contact became intermittent, and it was believed that the five aircraft by this point were more than 200 nautical miles out to sea east of Florida. Taylor radioed, "We'll fly 270 degrees west until landfall or running out of gas," and requested that a weather check at 17:24. By 17:50, several land-based radio stations had triangulated Flight 19's position as being within 100 nautical miles and within 100 nautical mile radius. Flight 19 was north of the Bahamas and well off the coast of Central Florida, but nobody transmitted this information on an open, repetitive basis. At 18:04, Taylor radioed to his flight, "Holding 270, we didn't fly far enough east. We may just as well turn around and fly back east again." By that time, the weather had deteriorated even more, and the sun had since set. Around 1820, Taylor's last message was received. It's also been reported that his last message was received in 1904. He's heard saying, "All planes close up tight. We'll have to ditch unless landfall. Then the first plane, when the first plane drops below 10 gallons, we all go down together."
Ooh, that gave me chills.
As it became obvious that the flight was lost, air bases, aircraft, and merchant ships were all alerted. The consolidated BPY Catalina departed at 1800 in search of Flight 19 and guided them back if they could be located. After dark, two Martin BPM Mariner flying boats, originally scheduled for their own training flight, were diverted to perform a square pattern search in the area. U.S. Navy Squadron Training Number 49, PBM-5, you got all those numbers, took off at 1927 from Air Naval Station Banana River, now Patrick Air Force Base, called in a routine radio message at 1930 and was never heard from again. At 21:15, the tanker U.S. Gaines Mills reported he had observed flames from an apparent explosion leaping 100 feet high and burning for 10 minutes. Captain Shona Stanley reported unsuccessfully searching for survivors through a pool of oil and aviation gasoline. The escort carrier USS Solomons also reported losing radar contact with an aircraft in the same position at the time. So basically, the five planes went missing, and then one of the flying boats
pretty much
went missing. Now, there were the Navy did an investigation, and they did a 500-page investigation report. Basically, flight leader Lieutenant Charles C. Taylor had mistakenly believed that the small islands he passed over were the Florida Keys, and his flight was over the Gulf of Mexico and was heading northwest to take them to Florida. It was determined that Taylor had passed over the Bahamas as scheduled. He did in fact lead his flight to the northeast over the Atlantic. The report noted that some subordinate officers did likely know their approximate position as indicated on the radio transmission, stating that they fly west and which would result in reaching the mainland. Taylor was not at fault because the compasses stopped working. The loss of BPM-5 was attributed to an explosion. The report was amended to cause unknown by the Navy after Taylor's mother contended that the Navy was unfairly blaming her son for the loss of five aircraft and 14 men, when the Navy had neither the bodies nor the airplanes as evidence. Now, had Flight 19 actually been where Taylor believed it to be, the flight would have made landfall within the Florida coastline within 20 minutes, depending on how far down they were. However, a later reconstruction of the incident showed that the island visible to Taylor were probably the Bahamas, well northeast of the Keys, and that Flight 19 was exactly where it should have been. The Board of Investigations found that because of his belief that he was on base course towards Florida, Taylor actually guided the flight further northeast out to sea. Further, it was general knowledge at NAS Fort Lauderdale that if a pilot ever became lost in the area to fly headed 270 degrees west or in evening hours towards the sunset if its compasses had failed. By the time the flight actually turned west, they were likely so far out at sea they had already passed the aircraft's fuel endurance. This factor combined with bad weather and the ditching characteristics of the Avenger meant that there was little hope for rescue, even if they had managed to stay afloat. Now, I've heard a couple different theories on this, because I've also heard reports that one of the transmissions was even the water looks weird. Now, that is not in the official transmissions. So when you pull up the official transmission back and forth, that is not in there, but that is something that I've heard over and over again.
That'd be something very common. I would think that if they had seen something weird had happened, they're describing stuff, the government would just be like, nope.
Yeah,
that never happened.
Well, they're in a common area,
yeah,
commonly known as the Bermuda Triangle.
No. Ooh.
So lots of things go missing and happen in this area.
A lot of compasses cut out in the Bermuda Triangle.
Now, incidences happen before this event.
Yeah.
And after.
Yeah.
I mean, this wasn't like the first one or the last one.
So planes and ships and everything go missing.
A lot of beliefs for the planes that go over this area that the compasses and the altitude readers and stuff go haywire. Is one of the beliefs is that there's a fault in that area underneath the sea that's creating air pockets, and as it releases, it's sending the plane, like giving the plane false readings as it comes up through the water and into the air. It's as pretty much a air pocket. This comes to the top of the water, you know, releases, and then it changes the air pressure so the plane doesn't know where it's at, and a lot of planes will drop because people think they're diving, so they'll, you know, pull up and install the plane and then fall into the water, or they'll think they're climbing, so they'll push down and...
And nosedive in.
I've watched a lot of stuff on the Bermuda Triangle. Seems really interesting.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's lots of different theories on it. There's everything. I mean... On the Flight 19, there's so many different conspiracy theories. You go from aliens to other paranormal experiences to government cover-ups.
I just want to throw this out there. You can't spell lost without LT.
That comes from a army soldier there, you know.
Now, say, I'm looking at Dave kind of drew a little map about like how the plans would have worked and everything. And I would, I mean, over what, 25,000 hours?
Yeah. 2,500.
2,500 hours. I don't see someone who's flown that much making just because his compass going out making that big of a mistake.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Especially being able to use the sun as a guide.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He would know exactly what direction he's going if he's flown that much.
Because it wasn't cloudy. It wasn't stormy.
No. I mean, it later became that way as the night progressed. But at the time, it wasn't. And now the rookies were flying. They were all flying. But the rookies were leading. But you would think he's the teacher. So he's got to stay on top of it. It's like when you're taking driver's ed. Your driver's ed instructor, yeah, you're driving, but he's got all the controls too. So he can take over if he needs to. Yeah, with his experience, he's also getting help from back at base. You know, put the sun on your, you know, port side and fly up the coast. Well, there's also a set of islands up there that are, they're called Keys.
Maybe.
Keys.
Maybe he forgot to say, no, your other port side.
They're Keys, which are... basically little islands like the Florida Keys. And one of the theories is he was flying over those and he thought, well, these are the Florida Keys. How did we get this far off course? And so then he tries to correct that, which then in turn just takes him
further
north and further east.
Yeah.
Out further to sea. So.
Because he's expecting to go northeast and hit Florida, but actually he's hitting on the other side off the.
Yeah.
The eastern coast of Florida.
And unlike the Pacific Ocean, there's not a whole lot of islands out there to...
Yeah.
Once you get past the Bahamas and all that, there's not a whole lot between here and, you know, Africa or Asia. Not Asia. Europe. There's a lot between here and Asia.
There's no continent, Amy.
But, so... Yeah, but at the same time with that... How did he get so off? I could see somebody who's only got 60 hours of, or even some of them were even no more than 30 hours of flight. I could see how they might be able to get a little confused.
Yeah.
But if the compasses all quit working.
Let's say at that point, at 2,500 hours, he would have been taught how to use the sun
and, that's exactly
and the
what
stars in the night to find his way home.
That's exactly what this whole mission was supposed to be doing, was teaching them how to navigate without timekeeping and all of that stuff and how to...
Is that why they didn't have any watches?
That's what it said, yeah. That it wasn't, oh, they it took wasn't it from that them? Well, it wasn't that important because that's what part of the mission was. Was navigation problem one.
Yeah.
Okay, you don't. You can't go. Okay, I should be at this point at two hundred hours.
Yeah,
I should be okay, and then I need. I'll be here at the checkpoint two at 230 hours, and they're not able to keep track of that, so they're having to go. Okay, we should be here, and then here, and then yeah.
And I mean, we already had somebody who's getting cocky with the, or getting agitated, I guess, with them saying, we just need to go west, go west. So there's obviously not a lot of trust either way, I feel like, between him and them and them and him.
I'm still thinking, though, no matter what, knowing the area you're at, I would have just gone west the whole time because you're going to hit land at that point. You're either going to hit the Gulf of Mexico or you're going to hit the coastline of Florida.
Yeah. And even if your compass isn't working, you're getting towards sunset. West is going to be where the sun is.
Yeah. You're going to be heading.
So, yeah.
Yeah. You should know your directions at that point.
Yeah. Fly so towards the sun.
That, and the only thing I think is that, so like, you know, they went through, you know, a dimension like the Bermuda Triangle. You know, people claim that it's like a dimensional rift or something like that, or something like that. If he'd gone something like that, and then he just completely lost sense of all direction.
Yeah, or maybe they all lost consciousness for a few seconds. I don't know.
It's also belief that, you know, the Earth is releasing methane gas in the Bermuda Triangle, and it's causing all different kinds of things to happen to the pilots when they fly over it, or ships when they cruise, when they go, you know.
Or maybe this is proof that the Earth is flat.
Yeah.
Oh, God.
I'd like to resign.
Yeah. Now, over the years, there have been many Avenger wreckages that have been mistaken for Flight 19. In fact, there was an author who wrote a whole book over this that he thought he had discovered Flight 19. He even paid to have it exhumed from the ocean. But upon investigation, of course, it was a different plane. There's been other treasure hunters that have hunted for it. And there have been many Avengers that have been found, but none of them have been these five Avengers. So then he goes, okay, well, where did they go? You know, I mean, we got divers that are looking for them. We got, you know, people spending lots and lots of money looking for them.
Just how many planes have they lost in this area to be finding a bunch of ones that aren't even part of this?
And why are they continuing to do this training exercise if they're constantly losing planes?
Well, first of all, quit naming it navigation problem. Obviously, it was set to fail to begin with. But no, I...
It's like Darwinism at its best. They're like, we're going to keep doing this. Yeah, well, we lost 12 more today. Yeah, we'll try again tomorrow. Oh, lost 24 today. Yeah, we're getting there.
This is just the Navy's way of getting rid of those that they didn't really want to enlist.
We only have 4 more in the academy. We'll send them out one by one.
Hey, we only lost 2 today. Hey, that's a record. We'll put that on the board.
Yeah, because this was 1942?
45.
Oh, and 45 is when this happened.
Yeah.
I'm sure their board that says, you know, no accidents at work. It's like zero.
Well, there were also rumors that the Germans had submarines U-boats. In the area.
Yeah.
The U-boats. And
If we have that one plane that explodes and they witness it exploding, could they have gone down and been captured by Germans? And then the Germans took the planes? I mean, that would be a possible theory, I would think. And then the U.S. government doesn't want people to start freaking out that the Germans are that close. Because at that point, we're not trying to get into the war at that point, are we?
War would have been over at that point.
You know, Amy,
I want to say the war ended late 42, if I'm right. I think it ended late 42 or early 43.
We'll just pause and so we can pretend like we know this stuff off the top of our head.
Like this.
Super important.
You know, Amy, okay, September 1945.
September 1945. So this is right after the war has ended.
Yeah.
So very well could have been some...
Still could have been
German U-boats or...
That hadn't got the order that they'd surrendered.
Yeah.
Or some Japanese...
Wrong coast.
Who knows?
Germans gathered in their U-boats.
So, yeah. I mean, when was the Cuban Missile Crisis?
It's in the 60s, wasn't it? 60s, 50s.
Yeah, it would have been.
Yeah, 61, I believe.
So it could have very well been even the United States didn't want people... They wanted people to believe the war was completely over. But there were still stragglers. Or maybe this was Hitler's U-boats taking them to Argentina.
I do have an interesting fact that I don't know if y'all know yet. They found two skeletons inside the bunker that Hitler and his wife were in. Mm-hmm. And the Russians took them, right? And they've held them for all these years. They did a DNA test on them. They're both female skeletons.
Yeah.
Really?
Yep.
So Hitler is in Arva Scotia? That's not even a country. Well, but okay. He's so, Argentina.
So to be off completely note, there's two not correct theories, but two theories that currently exist. One is he went to Argentina. The other is that he's in a secret bunker living out his life, along with all the other people that have mysteriously disappeared or faked their own death.
So there's also a belief that he went to Argentina and then the Nazis actually have a secret base in Antarctica.
Yes.
Mm. Oh my goodness. I just ran a number on that because I was like, how many planes are they losing? Records show that training accidents between 1942 and 1945 accounted for the loss of 95 aviation personnel from NAS Fort Lauderdale.
Jesus.
So that was the base you didn't want to get stationed at for
They're
training.
Losing 20 planes a year.
Hold on. Can you imagine this conversation? Ma'am, we're sorry to inform you that your son, he's been lost at sea. You know, I told Gerald, that's not the place to go if you want to learn how to fly. That's the place you go if you want to learn how to die.
So I had to see someone. We lost him at sea. He was in the Air Force. What the fuck?
You just keep flying, man. The land's right there.
Well, you know, two of those were Marines. We had two Navy pilots and two Marines.
Which I think technically at the time it was...
I'll say Navy and Air Force were, I think...
It was still the Army.
Yeah.
Because the Air Force wasn't... If I'm thinking right, Truman created it after... in 46.
When did he become a pilot? He told me he was a cook. Yeah. How did he get lost at sea?
But, I mean, there's lots of different theories on what happened to Flight 19. And it's... You look up missing aviation, and it's always on the top of the list because they just vanished. Now, you read the transcripts, and you think, okay, they crashed because they were running out of gas.
Isn't
okay. But you would think there's five planes, and there were people there within.
I mean, well,
also minutes.
You're thinking
they would have seen something. You would think
so. 25. You're looking at. Five planes. I'd say you're looking at close to 3,000 hours worth of flight experience.
Yeah.
Somehow they should have known where the hell they were.
Yeah.
My question is the area that encases the Bermuda Triangle, is there still like a off limits to it?
No, people,
they go through
commercial
it.
Commercial planes fly through it all the time.
Yeah.
Cruise ships go through it all the time.
I mean, it's not like every plane that goes through there gets lost. It's just like
it just happens
randomly.
To be a place where a lot of them tend to go missing. And it's, I mean, it's a large area. Yeah. It's not like it's a 100 by 100 by 100 triangle. Like, it's miles wide.
Yeah. And what I find so interesting in this is that it's two different flights that go missing in the same like 3 hour span. You know, yeah, there's six airplanes that just disappear because they never found wreckage from the boat plane and they never found any survivors or victims of the crashes. So they just vanish. all in the same area within 3 hours of each other. It leads you to, it gives you lots of room for conspiracy theory.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right, guys. Let's just level it down. We all know this is true. It was Godzilla. And he's like, hey!
Again, wrong ocean.
Damn it.
Okay. No, not true. I watched Godzilla King of Monsters today. And there's a point where him and Ghidorah are fighting in Washington or in Boston.
Yeah.
So yeah. He had to have come through the ocean.
Also, that's where the tea party was.
And they flooded, the monsters flooded in Washington, D.C.
Really what it is these guys were like, you know, I'm tired. We just got out of the war. I'm tired of being in the military. We're in Florida.
Fuck this.
Let's just land.
They actually just landed in the Keys.
We'll just ditch and go. Like,
let's go to Cuba.
Or off the Florida Keys.
Yeah, or you know, all those hijackers that wanted to go to Cuba. These guys landed there because they knew they weren't going to get extradited back to the United States. So they're just like, "Hey, we'll just hang out in Cuba for a while." Because I mean, it's not until 20 years later that we discovered that you had to worry about Cuba. So there you go.
Also, that's where the Angel of Death was.
One of those guys became Fidel Castro.
Holy shit.
That was forced.
Oh man. He was like, God, that's a hard theory to go off of. I can't even make a joke about that one.
Yeah. So either that was not even a theory that I got covered, but that just popped into my head. It's like, yeah, the war just ended.
They wanted to escape. They said, fuck this.
These guys were like, fuck this, I'm done. And they're like, we're in Florida.
Like, I signed up to kill fucking Germans, and now that that's off the table, I'm out.
Yeah, they probably landed somewhere near the Everglades, ditched the planes in the Everglades, and
these guys are like, I'm only 14. I lied about my age.
Even better, there.
I don't even know how to spell plane.
They're the original. The original Team America. So they flew to Cuba, and the whole time they were there, they were like, America, fuck yeah. Yeah. Going to kill some motherfucking Cubans, yeah.
They're the little rascals crew.
But yeah. Don't know if they're alive. Well,
we don't know if any of them are any of ours.
Missing navigations, if they survived or if they died. I mean, most of them are probably gone now. Some of them, they could still be alive. But, I mean, with the Malaysia air flight from last week, that they could all still be alive.
Yeah.
Sorry, guys. That was a time slip.
From 15 minutes ago, because we're recording this all in one night.
Cut it out. We don't do that. They must never know the illusion.
I don't know. These were interesting things to cover.
They were kind of fun things to cover. I enjoyed it, actually.
It made me not want to fly anywhere for a while.
I already didn't like flying in the first place, so.
I've never flown over an ocean, but now I really don't want to.
Yeah, I've learned that I'm claustrophobic, so fuck planes now. Yeah.
Yeah, I do have to say that in a disappearance, it's better when you don't end the story with, and then the skeleton was found and the DNA confirmed that, yep, not only were the parents dead, but the children were dead also.
See, it's kind of weird, but I'm glad that like none of these stories kind of ended in like, and they found the plane crash and all 227 souls had perished on board. You know?
These all leave you with a little bit of hope and a lot of fun with conspiracy theory.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. This was, like I said, I've enjoyed this episode mainly because I love conspiracy theories. So yeah. I got to come up with a whole lot of new ones.
Yes. And we'll do more of these. We'll have to pick another theme. We've done planes. We'll have to do boats. We'll have to do some ghost ships, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Shit. I shouldn't have followed that name. Dave, that was you. That was you. I'm sorry.
I love ghost ships.
Do the partitions know that you like ghost ships?
Fuck,
have you told them?
Yeah.
And then he starts stroking his water bottle.
Agua.
Okay.
Ghost ships.
In other news.
Well, make sure to check out our
podcast.
Instagram.
Your Instagram?
Oh, yes, check out our podcast as they're listening, Eli. Check out our Facebook.
If you haven't listened to our podcast yet, go ahead and download it.
Yes, because they start at the end and work their way backwards.
Hey, man, some people do that with movies. I wouldn't just try to do that with podcasts.
Like, does this one end funny or sad?
Yeah.
I do that with those scream videos. Like, anytime there's a video and I kind of start questioning whether or not it's going to have, like, a scream at the end, I always go to the end. And then if there's no scream, I go back and watch it. If there is a scream, I'm like, fuck you. And then I turn it off.
You just scrub it down.
I don't do jump scares. But yeah, follow us on the social medias, Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at UNP Normalcy. And our website is umpnormalcy.com. And there you can read about us, see our gorgeous faces, listen to our podcasts from the website.
You can send us messages on there.
You can send us messages on there.
I'll reply to any message. Just hit me up in my DMs.
Slide into them DMs. And then Patreon. You can get to our Patreon through our website, or it's patreon.com/UMPNormalcy.
I'm an old Dungeons & Dragons player, so anytime I hear DM, I think Dungeon Master. So it's like, slide into my Dungeon Master.
Look at my level 75 Excalibur. I'm ready to slide into your...
Dave slid into the DM a couple times.
And he pillaged twice. And he pillaged her village.
So I've only DM'd once. So.
And then we just didn't listen.
And you guys, you just made it like the worst experience ever, so I never DM again.
I heard that they just leveled up.
Oh, no, they just built tunnels.
We built an entire... base, and Avery just kept sending wave after wave after us, trying to kill us.
We were all having fun.
Yeah.
Amy wasn't.
Like, how can I fucking get these guys to move? That was like the thing is, they weren't adventuring. They were just like hunkered down in their base.
And we just kept building and like digging tunnels, and we happened to find a pit of tar that we used to light traps. Amy's like, how are you finding all this stuff? It's not even part of the storyline.
It's just like rolls.
Yeah.
Yes. So don't DM for Dave and Chad. And I think that's it. So until next time.
Keep digging.